Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Keith O'Brien. He's a former reporter for the Boston Globe and a frequent contributor to National Public Radio, but we're talking about his new book, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. Keith, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
This is like one of those books that's got everything. It's got derring do. It's got races. It's got great stories of women who really challenged the male supremacy and stuff like and came out fine. A lot of them, some of them. What brought you to this story?
So, ironically enough, I was on an airplane in 2016, early 2016, when I stumbled onto this story. I was reading a different book, and there was a paragraph that was just historical background about daring women in the early part of the 20th century. And in this paragraph, there was one line about an all-female airplane race in 1929.
Oh,
man. And it just stopped me because I had never heard of such a thing. And, you know, I'm a journalist, and I'm always looking for story ideas, whether it's for radio or magazines or books. And so I just followed it down, and I followed it down. And once I was in a library living in old microfilm in the late 1920s, this whole world emerged that had I really had no idea existed. It was the world of the air races. It was one of the most popular sports at the time, and the women, of course, they wanted in. They wanted a race.
It's incredible because this was the big sports event. You talk about the crowds that would show up at these different races or at these different long-distance events. They were enormous for that time period.
They'd be enormous even now, you know.
Yeah.
125,000 paying fans in a single day.
Wow.
Just as many would watch for free from the hoods of their automobiles parked on nearby highways. 500,000 people in a single weekend. You know, one thing that was really telling to me is cities like Cleveland and Chicago and Los Angeles, they would vie against each other, you know, bidding on the right to host the races in the way that cities do today for, say, the Super Bowl. I mean, that's what this meant. That's how big these races were.
Now, this is mainly about five different women. Everybody's heard of Amelia Earhart, and we'll talk about her in a bit. But these other women are just not well-known names at all. And after reading your book, I'm really surprised because these women accomplished a lot. There's Ruth Elder, Ruth Nichols, and I'm going to mispronounce name, Louise McFedridge Thaden.
And you got it.
Florence Klingensmith?
Florence Klingensmith, that's right.
These women were amazing, and why aren't they household names like Amelia Earhart?
Well, that's a really difficult question, and it's certainly one that I've wrestled with. You know, I want to be very clear to listeners, you know, that this is one specific narrative about women fighting for the right to fly and the right to race airplanes. And, you know, these characters that form the heart and soul of this book, you know, weren't the only five female aviators at this time, but they were rivals and they were friends, and, you know, they were the sort of women who would be at one another's bedside when they crashed, you know, and all
absolutely
of them did crash. And so really this is a story of an ensemble cast, you know, fighting for one thing. And as to why the others are forgotten, I think it's got to do with a few things. You know, by 1937, just objectively, Amelia Earhart was the most accomplished and also the most famous female aviator in this country. You know, when she disappears, people are, of course, enthralled by the mystery of it all. And the other thing, though, that people have forgotten is, you know, Amelia Earhart was married to George Putnam,
right,
who was of Putnam Publishing fame. And he was really a media magnate of his time. And he helped keep Amelia in the news.
Got it.
Her, you know, while she was alive and even after she died. And so I think the combination of her fame, her mystery, and the large publicity machine at her back really sucks all the oxygen out of the room for these other women.
There are many stories in this book, but one of them is their constant fighting against male expectations of how women should be and what they should do. And the level of that that comes out in this book is incredible. And these women were not to be denied. They banded together and they held their ground. But it is amazing the crap that happened to these women.
They had to fly through so much, you know, literally. You know, at every turn, the race organizers, who were all men, and the newspaper reporters, who were almost always all men, threw up obstacles for these women, you know. In that first all-women's air race in 1929, you know, the women had fought for that right. You know, they had won it in, and they lobbied to fly in the races in a transcontinental derby from Santa Monica to Cleveland. And the men were intrigued by this. They knew that it would draw a lot of headlines if the women raced. But they wanted them to race on their terms, on the men's terms. And those terms initially were these. They wanted them, each woman, to be accompanied by a man. and they didn't want them flying from Santa Monica across the Rocky Mountains. They wanted them to fly from Omaha to Cleveland or Minneapolis to Cleveland because they were worried, quote, about the women's stamina. You know, Amelia Earhart, Louise Sade, and Ruth Nichols, Ruth Elder, these women who are at the heart and soul of this story, they refused to abide by those rules. And they vowed to boycott the race. And this gets the race organizers' attention because you could not have an all-female air race in 1929 without those women.
That's right.
So they agree to let them race, but they force the women to stop 15 times.
Jesus.
You know, the men in these days could in a derby like this, could take off from Los Angeles, refuel whatever they wanted, and land in Cleveland. The women were forced to check in at 15 different pit stops along the way. You know, Amelia Earhart, Louise Sade, and the others, they agree to these rules because they know it's the only way they're going to race.
But the story gets even queerer because there's all these reports of sabotage on almost every single stop.
Well, right, especially on the second stop in San Bernardino, California, several women reported that their planes had been tampered with. You know, that one woman reported that her brace wires, the wires that connect the wings to the fuselage, that her brace wires would snap that day as if they had been clipped by pliers. It was never proven, but it certainly isn't out of the realm of possibility, you know, because, you know, men were threatened.
That's right.
And even, you know, I should say, you know, older women were threatened by these young women in their 20s, you know, trying to break into what had been almost exclusively a men's game.
One of the things you do really well in this book, Keith, is to give people a sense of what it was like to fly at this time period. And you did that right in the introduction. People need to put this in perspective. The 20s and the 30s, it's sort of a golden age of aviation because everybody's getting into it or everybody's fascinated by it. But it was extremely dangerous. It was dangerous because of how the planes were made and just basically the number of things that could go wrong.
That was one of the most stunning things to me, is just how dangerous it was. You know, you couldn't fly in bad weather, period. You know, you couldn't fly in a rainstorm. You couldn't fly in fog or low cloud cover. You couldn't fly in snow or ice. You couldn't fly at night. You know, so you're limited there. And then, you know, once you were flying, things happened to these primitive air traveling machines that just don't happen today. You know, like most alarming to me was at times the wings of these planes would just fall off, just fall off for reasons unknown. And, you know, it had something to do with how the planes were built typically during this time. You know, there was real debate about whether metal planes would ever really travel. would ever really fly.
Because they weigh too much. Because they weigh too much.
They weigh too much. And weight was the ultimate obstacle to getting into the air. And so most planes in the mid and even late 1920s were built out of wood and linen that was really stretched across the wood ribbing and then pulled tight and covered with a lacquer to make it firm and weather resistant. But it's wood and linen, and you know that wood could rot and you would have no idea.
And the linen can certainly tear.
The linen could tear and did tear. Often, especially under the strain of high speeds, and when it tore, you know, especially on the wing, you could have a real problem there. You essentially now have a wing, you know, riddled with holes.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Keith O'Brien, former reporter for the Boston Globe and frequent contributor to National Public Radio, and we're talking about his book. You want to talk about a book that's just sort of a real great read all the way through. It's Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. One of the things I loved learning about Amelia Earhart was that she grew up right here in Massachusetts, in Medford, which sounded like, even then, it was sort of like a boring town to have grown up in, and she was looking to get out.
Yeah, so she doesn't grow up there exactly, but she moves there in her 20s, and it's not where she planned to be in her life at that point. She had drifted a good bit. Her parents had divorced. Her mother moves to Medford, where her other daughter has a job teaching school, and Amelia joins them there. And you know, she has a pilot's license at that time. This is 1925, 26, but she's not a famous pilot. She hasn't accomplished much. And you know, when she moves to Medford, she struggles and struggles to find work, struggles to keep work, and ultimately gets a job working as a social worker on Tyler Street in Boston's Chinatown neighborhood.
And she's really good at it.
She is. You know, she was incredibly smart. You can't listen to how she speaks if you ever you know, are able to listen to old radio accounts. She was so smart in how she spoke, how she handled herself. And she was very compassionate. She was always thinking about others. And so she made a great social worker and was really beloved at the Denison House, as it was known, on Tyler Street, where she served new immigrants to this country and really helped them get started here by teaching them English and other things like that.
It seems like she wanders around in her mind and in her careers for a while, and it seems like she ultimately finds herself in aviation. But one of the things she was outstanding at, and you talked about this, is organizing and speaking to groups across the country to really promote women in aviation.
She was always on the lecture circuit, especially after she becomes famous in 1928. You know, she becomes this desired speaker. You know, people would pay money in during the Great Depression, mind you, to come hear her speak at your town hall or your church or your library. And you know, her message was often the same, whether she was speaking to undergraduates at Yale University or speaking to Kansas housewives. She really was fighting for women and fighting for equality, and you know, would say things like, you know, men need to know the stupidity of housework and women need to know the drudgery of holding down a job. You know, she also advocated for a very radical idea in the mid-1930s. She advocated that women, young women, should be drafted and should serve as soldiers just as men do. As she said, you know, if women were drafted, if women were part of this pool, it would give male politicians pause about sending us to war. And I think she was right. You know, I think she's right about all of those things.
There are so many great stories in this book, and I just want to allude to a few and talk about a few. Lindbergh, obviously Lindbergh's flight across the Atlantic was a huge inspiration for everybody, men and women. I want to talk about Ruth Elder's attempt to fly across the Atlantic.
Sure. So
talk about who Ruth Elder is and the Ruth Ribbon.
So, you know, most people have forgotten Ruth Elder, and most people have forgotten, you know, how this race to be the first woman to get across the ocean really evolves. And it begins right about this time, actually, just after Labor Day, September 1927. Charles Lindbergh has flown the Atlantic 4 months earlier, and he has done so, it's important to point out, not just for the pioneering spirit of it all. He's done it for a jackpot of money. $25,000 have been put up for the first man, it was expected to be a man, to fly from Paris to New York or New York to Paris nonstop. And so Lindbergh has made this flight. He has won this money. He has come home and now toured across America in his Spirit of St. Louis. And he's inspired young women now to want to fly the ocean. And the first one is Ruth Elder. She is a native of Alabama. She's flashy and Southern. She is already on her second marriage at age 24 and living in Lakeland, Florida, where she is answering phone calls at a dentist's office. It's not the life that Ruth had imagined for herself. And so that September, she gets financial backers who buy her a plane, $35,000 to buy a plane that was named the American Girl. And she's going to fly it with a male co-pilot from New York to Paris. She's going to go across the ocean.
There's so many great details in your retelling of this. One of the things I love is the things that they packed for the trip, like how many sandwiches, and they would like pack thermoses of coffee for the several day trip.
And you're right. It is that's another thing that people have forgotten. You know, we take flying to Europe now for granted. You know, you can take off in Boston and be in Paris in the morning. At that time, to fly across the ocean was going to take you, at best, 33 hours.
Jesus.
33 hours. It typically would be two nights in the air. Two nights. And then maybe you make it. Maybe.
And, you're flying out over the ocean, and you have no sense of where you... I mean, there's no radio communication or anything like that. There's a thing that happens, and when I read this, I was just amazed. They're sort of lost in the air, and they see a ship below.
Yeah.
And what they do is they decide to communicate with the ship. How did they do that?
So, when you were over the ocean at the time, at best, if your plane had a radio, the only thing you could communicate with was passing ships. The American Girl did not have a radio. They had packed like this rudimentary radio, but it was not part of the plane. And so, they're 32 hours into this flight. They're having serious problems with the oil pressure on the plane. And they're really having doubts about whether they have enough fuel now to make it to the mainland Europe. They see this Dutch freighter flying below them, cruising below them. It's the first ship they've seen in 11 hours. And they fly low to it, and they drop a message. They drop a message to it on the deck of the plane, asking, where are we? And then they circle while the sailors on board this freighter paint out on the deck where they are. And they're still 300 miles before they're going to reach the Azores. And they instantly realize, we are not going to make it to France. We're not going to make it to France. We're going to die. We're going to crash in this. We're going to run out of gas, crash into the ocean, and die. And so they circle back and shout at the ship that they're going to ditch. And that's what they do. They they essentially crash land their plane, this famous plane, $35,000. That's more than $300,000 in today's money. And they crash it into the ocean just beside this freighter, and that's how they're saved by the sailors on board.
The whole idea of just throwing a message down to the surface of the ship and then having them communicate back is mind-blowing. And in some cases, in other cases of these people who are traveling across water, they miss the ship with the message. And it just doesn't work out. Now, there are a lot of great stories, and there's a lot of heartbreaking stories. Florence Clinton Smith and the GB Racer, that was a heartbreaking story.
It's a devastating story and really an infuriating story. The GB airplane.
I can remember as a kid, I made a model of it because it was such it was such a wild looking plane. It was crazy looking. And I loved it as a kid. And I made an Aurora model kit of it. And everything that was mentioned around that racer was Jimmy Doolittle. But no, there was no mention of Florence.
Well, the GB was built right there, in your backyard. It was built in Springfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. It was, as you said, a very unusual looking plane. It was short, stubby. It was shaped very much like a bullet, and the cockpit was way in the back of this little stubby plane,
right next to the tail.
Yeah, right next to the tail. Doolittle, who you mentioned, he said that flying a GB was like trying to balance an ice cream cone on the tip of your finger. It was impossible. That's how Doolittle described it. But they were very fast, some of the fastest planes of this time. And in 1933, Florence Clinton Smith, one of the top female aviators of this time, is offered the opportunity to race, not just against the women, but against the men, in a pylon race in Chicago. Pylon races, you need to imagine a triangular course laid out on the ground with small towers, 50-foot towers that people called pylons. And you would whip your plane around these pylons, in a group with other planes, just like NASCAR in the sky. It was incredibly dangerous. Men died in these sort of races all the time, and when they did, when the men would die in the pylon races, they were hailed as heroes.
That's right.
And they were sometimes given these grand tributes right there on the field that weekend, with 21 gun salutes and flybys and their ashes scattered from the sky, while people held their hats over their hearts. Florence Clinton Smith is going to race the GB against the men that day.
And she knew exactly what she was getting into. And she was the kind of pilot who thought that, obviously she could master the GB.
Well, and she proved it early in the race.
That's right.
She was at the eyewitnesses reported later that when she reached the end of lap one, she banked her plane so hard, so perfectly there at the home pylon, 220 miles an hour, just 70 feet, 50 feet off the ground.
Wow.
That they knew she was something, and they knew she knew what she was doing. It is sadly seven laps later at that home pylon, on the eighth turn, that the fabric, the linen that is stretched around the spruce ribbing of the right wing of that GB fails and begins to tear off in chunks. Everybody sees it. Some people, hear it. Hear the sound of the fabric tearing away. And Florence Clinton Smith does exactly as she was supposed to do. She peels off course. She flies away from the crowd. She tries to gain altitude to save herself. She's really trying to save people on the ground because, if she lost control of this plane around the grandstand, around the crowds, it could kill dozens, kill scores of people. And, she does everything right, and the plane goes down anyway because there are holes in the wing. And, Florence dies that day. And, it is really, for me, the turning point in the book, and really the Velcro around which everything sticks. Because right. You know, when Florence dies, they don't do what they did with the men. You know, they don't say, well, let's give this woman a grand tribute this weekend and let's honor her for her sacrifice to aviation. Instead, they blame her.
That's right.
They blame her.
She lacks stamina,
and that is why the plane went down. And, you know, as someone who lived inside this story, you know, for 2.5 years, who got to know these women in you know, a deep and personal way, I was just so insulted by how they treated Florence. You know, you know, she gave everything. She gave everything to aviation, and she didn't get even the most basic, decent human respect.
Well, first of all, how did they ship her body home?
Florence was from rural Minnesota, just across the river from Fargo, North Dakota. And when they received her body there that week, the coroner reported that she was naked and wrapped in newspapers in a simple pine box. He would give an oral history much later in the 1970s, and this coroner would say that in 50 years of shipping and receiving bodies, you know, for funerals, that he never saw another case like it. He never saw another human treated with such disrespect.
We're going to have to end it there because we are completely out of time. We can obviously be talking about this book for hours. And there's great stories of triumph. And I think the most fascinating part, and I don't want to give anything away, is what happens to them down the line. There's some positive stories and some not so positive stories. It's fascinating. My guest tonight has been Keith O'Brien, former reporter for the Boston Globe, frequent contributor to National Public Radio. And we've been talking about his book, Fly Girls, how five daring women defied all odds and made aviation history. Keith, it's been a real pleasure.
Mark, thanks so much for having me.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.